Now, your host, Michael Cohen, with the Capital City Recap on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
Hey, we're back. Michael Cohen, producer James Platy on the board. Almost a year ago, a three-pronged disaster rocked the nation of Japan, an earthquake, tsunami, and a resulting nuclear crisis. What happened on March 11th of last year? Well, since then, Dr. Ethan Siegel, associate professor of Japanese history at MSU, has visited the northeastern part of Japan that was directly affected, and he joins me now to talk about what happened since that fateful day. Dr. Siegel, thank you very much for coming on the program tonight.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
You know, it seems like the world would have wanted to avoid going anywhere near this catastrophe following the disaster that occurred there. What led you to visit the northeastern part of Japan?
Well, I've been involved in travel to and the study of Japan for over two decades now. I had both personal and research connections to that particular region of the country. And, of course, a disaster of this size, poses a lot of challenges for the nation as a whole and potential lessons, not only for the people of Japan, but for the rest of us around the world and how to manage these kinds of disasters.
How soon after the incident were you there?
I've made several trips since then. The first was in July of last year. The most recent one was last month in February.
Well, like any disaster that happens on the other side of the world, you know, we saw the images on television, these cars and so on floating by in the water, and we heard about the concerns about radioactivity. But what did you see when you actually arrived there?
Well, in July, I visited a coastal town in the northernmost of the three prefectures most seriously hit by the tsunami, the town of Rikuzen Takata. And in that particular town, and this was, more than 3 months after the tsunami had hit, it still really looked like a devastated landscape. You saw very few buildings standing, and those were merely shells. The water had reached basically every building, three floors or lower had been destroyed. And there were a few buildings that were stood, but almost nothing left. And in those, you saw trees and other debris sticking out of third-floor windows, revealing how high the water had been. And on the outskirts of town, you saw just mountains of debris and, graveyards of cars, very well organized, and it must have taken a huge amount of effort just to achieve that. But still, I mean, the scale of the devastation was almost mind-boggling.
And in terms of the concerns about radioactivity in the region, was there any at that point? And I guess if you could remind us, how close was that situation to becoming much more serious?
Well, the situation, we learned very recently, was very close to becoming much more serious. There was actually a report filed on March 1st, just a few days ago, in the Bulletin of Concerned Atomic Scientists by a kind of blue ribbon panel in Japan that has been investigating the way the nuclear reactor situation was handled. And although it did not reach those levels, the report does reveal that the government was beginning or trying to begin even preparations for the possible evacuation of Tokyo, which I believe is the largest city in the world, 30 million people. Fortunately, things did not reach that level of crisis, but they still were quite severe. So another one of the communities that I visited in early February was situated about 18 to 20 kilometers away from the nuclear reactor at Fukushima. And this particular town is now a ghost town. I mean, there are no people there. It's within the evacuation zone. And even we were only allowed to go in for a few hours. I was taken there by a middle school principal who is now a principal of a school with no students. And he's very upset about the way the government, and particularly the Tokyo Electric Power Company, handled, or in this case, I guess, mishandled the situation. And it's really not clear if that community is ever going to come back again.
So just to clarify then, there's a whole region now that is uninhabitable because of radioactivity?
Well, I guess it depends how you define region. We're talking about a zone of about 20 to 25 kilometers. So that's, about 15 to 18 miles surrounding the plant. And, of course, the radiation didn't spread out evenly, so there's some variation within that. We're not talking about the whole northeast of the country, but there is a small region that contains a number of villages and towns that currently the citizens all are residing either in temporary housing or they've moved in with relatives in other towns or have just relocated.
I'm talking to Ethan Siegel, Associate Professor of Japanese History at MSU. I mean, was this not ultimately, and don't the citizens in the area there feel that this was a natural disaster, that there was really no way to avoid the resulting nuclear crisis?
You know, the answer is yes and no. On the one hand, this particular earthquake at 9.0 magnitude is considered one of the largest in recorded history. And the tsunami produced waves as high as 20 meters, it seems, in some places, which are a little over 60 feet, which far exceeded what people had expected, including the designers of the nuclear power plant. And certainly, we all have to recognize, even those of us who are somewhat critical of the government's response, that this was an unprecedented event. That being said, there were other aspects of the management of the crisis that were not handled perhaps as well as they could have been. And that certainly exacerbated the problems. Poor communication between the electric company and the government, not very adequate safety measures in place on the ground, no communication, as was, I think, reported in the press at the time, between the power plant and the local fire department, for example, things that could have been put in place that certainly would have helped, although they wouldn't have prevented the crisis.
Well, when you compare the way the government in Japan responded to that crisis to our own response here in the U.S. to the impact of Hurricane Katrina, is there any kind of real difference? Did they somehow respond in a better way?
Well, I have not had the chance to study Katrina and the way that response was handled. But based on what I've just read in the press, it seems like, yes, the response was a little more effective in the case of Japan. And they had learned lessons from their own previous disaster. And I'm speaking now of the 1995 earthquake that destroyed much of the city of Kobe. In that case, there, for example, had been resistance to sending the self-defense forces in right away to aid people. That resistance, you know, was not an issue this time. They immediately sent the self-defense forces in, as well as all kinds of medical personnel to aid people. And although there are still many people living in temporary housing communities and many people in search of work, the government does appear to have taken its responsibility very seriously. They've created a new reconstruction ministry that's supposed to help cut through red tape and enable businesses to restart more quickly, though that just started in February, so it's a little early to tell if it's made a difference yet or not.
So the tens of thousands of people that were displaced, I mean, at this point, has life gotten somewhat back to normal for many of them in new locations, or are many of them still very much relying on the government?
There are a lot of people who are still dependent on government aid. There are some, of course, who have managed to resettle in other locations, either because they don't want to return to their former homes or because they just feel they can't wait around for, you know, questions to be resolved. There are others, though, who are still living in these temporary housing units. According to a recent NHK News report, I've seen as many as 110,000 people still living in temporary housing communities, and that doesn't include those who are living with relatives or just moved on and chosen to rent or buy a new home somewhere else. So a lot of people still very much dependent on the help of others. And one of the problems is it's not clear how or when they'll be allowed to rebuild on their old land, because although this tsunami is certainly not a regular occurrence, there's no way to predict when another one might hit. And so will the government declare this land safe or unsafe? And if so, what will happen to it and how those people will be compensated? These questions haven't yet been resolved.
You know, one last thing, these disasters, we seem to forget about them so quickly sometimes, whether it's in Haiti or Japan. From what you could tell, the Japanese public, is this something they've kind of put behind them mostly?
No, I don't think so at all. I think in here in the United States, you know, a number of other news stories quickly diverted our attention away. There was the situation in the Middle East with the Arab Spring. There were the financial crises in Europe and in our own country. But in Japan, it's still very much something you see reports on the news, both on television and in the papers, almost every day.
Dr. Ethan Siegel, Associate Professor of Japanese History at Michigan State University. Ethan, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.